This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Welcome to this week's edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks with me, Michelle Owen, from Sky Sports News and Soccer Saturday.
Sam Matterface from Talk Sport and ITV Sport.
Alex Crook from Talk Sport and National Newspaper Journalist.
And coming up this week, find out if Crook managed to actually get through an interview with Jurgen Klopp without annoying him.
I'll be taking you to Stamford Bridge and the tunnel where Pep Guardiola was quite emotional after Chelsea ended Manchester City's unbeaten run.
And we'll also be debating Raheem Sterling's suggestions some newspapers incite racism with the former Fulham and West Ham player Leroy Rossini.
And I'll be chatting to my Sky Sports colleague Kelly Cates about whether having a world-famous footballer for a dad helped or hindered her career.
I think there was probably a time when I did feel as though I wanted to kind of to stand on my own two feet and to be a sort of person who's separate from that. But then, not now. I think I feel now I'm really proud of what he's done.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Well, it was yet another weekend which threw up plenty of talking points, from the Sterling racism storm to Manchester City's Invincibles being not that invincible after all, and Lukaku finally scoring at Old Trafford, to Ralph Rabbit Hutch proving the new manager bounce is a myth after all. Let's kick things off by taking a look at the main headlines in numbers.
Well, I was privileged to see Mo Salah bag his second Liverpool hat-trick in the new league leaders' 4-0 win at Bournemouth. Only Lionel Messi has netted more goals than the Egyptian since the start of last season, and his third on Saturday was an absolute pearler.
Manchester City's surprise 2-0 defeat at Chelsea means the champions fell one game short of setting a new club record for their longest unbeaten away run in the top flight.
And the appointment of Ralf Hasenhüttl did not have the immediate impact that Southampton hoped for. They lost 1-0 at Cardiff. It means they're now on their longest winless run in all competitions since 1989.
Yeah, I think Saints are pretty doomed, to be honest. Why do we never mention United in this bit when they win?
That's because we like to wind you up, Crook. On that subject, how was your mate Jurgen Klopp when you interviewed him on Saturday?
Do you know what? He was brilliant. It was probably the most convivial interview that we've had together. He was funny. He was charming. He ripped the mickey out of the BBC Radio 5 live reporter who stumbled over his words. He said, "Will you be watching Manchester City later?" Of course, he meant to say Manchester City. And Jurgen found that very amusing. He said, "I'm glad you called them Manchester City and not me," and proceeded to have a chuckle to himself. I asked him if they'd sent out a statement to Manchester City, not Silly, with that victory over Bournemouth and the ease of it. But he came up with a really good answer, actually. He said, "We're not in the business of sending out statements. We've got 42 points now." And he said, "It usually takes me until April to get 42 points. Not sure that's strictly true, but it was a good way of deflecting the attention away from Liverpool and what was a very good performance.
When is it ever taking him till April to get 42 points? What, when he was at Mainz or something?
Yeah. I think that's what he was referring to. And there was one season when Dortmund really struggled under him as well, wasn't it?
That's a bit odd. But it sounds like you had a bit of a love-in with him, which was nice, because, you know, usually he falls out with you. So you must be much happier today.
I am. Yeah. He's in my
good. Jurgen Klopp fan club down on the south coast is well and truly in full swing. And now I want you to help me out here. Can you work out who said this weekend in the tunnel at Stamford Bridge? "You cannot imagine what a feeling as a manager it is to see my team play the way we played. Better than for the last season, for example."
Now, you see, the thing is, I know that you were obviously at that game, and the fact you've said, "Can you imagine who this is," would suggest it's Pep, because he normally comes off and comes up with some weird comments when they lose. So it's Pep, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't the words of the victorious Maurizio Sarri, who just sort of looked a little bit bemused, really, that his team had managed to pull it off. But Pep was very, very emotional after the game. He said he had no regrets. "When we lose, I want us to lose playing in that way." He also had a little bit of a pop at suggestions that his team were ever going to be invincible. And he doesn't like you using that word, Crook. So when you said that earlier, he'd be very angry with you, and he would get the ump with you in the tunnel if you said that. The only thing was that actually in the huddle that I was in, no one actually asked him about being invincible. It's interesting because as a radio reporter, as you know, Crook, and as a television reporter, Michelle, you don't get the full spectrum of questions that you'd want to ask or you want to see being answered. If you're in a press conference, it might go on for 15 minutes and you might get different questions from different publications, and everybody eventually will get pretty much everything you want out of a manager in some circumstances. But when you're in that tunnel right at the end of a game and you've only got 3 or 4 minutes, there's only certain things you can ask. I wanted to ask about the defeat, the impact of the defeat, the lack of a cutting edge, and did Sergio Aguero's absence cause them a problem, and the game overall. But he wanted to bring it up. He was asked quite reasonably by our good friend John Murray, who we all like very much and he's very polite, if the game had underlined the challenge that this league provides. The response was 1 minute and 39 seconds long. And in a context of a radio interview, that is a rant, isn't it? That is a rant. You don't have to tell me that. It's you and your analysts. You said that we're invincible and perfect, how good we are and how we're going to win in February the title. It's you, all of you, not the players, not the manager, all of you. Maybe other people had mentioned to him that they'd sort of thought about the invincibility of the team in the TV interviews, but we certainly hadn't done that in the radio interviews. He wanted to get it out. That was his narrative. He wanted it out there on Saturday night. I never said we were going to be invincible. That was the line he wanted people to write.
Was that to deflect from his players?
I don't know if it was to deflect from his players, but he wanted to make it known that he never even countenanced it. He wanted it to be known that it was never in his thoughts, that he never believed it was possible. And probably because it wasn't. I never felt that it was possible. I don't know about you, Crook, but I think this league is very, very different to those days when, you know, Arsenal would go and fluke a whole season unbeaten, but they certainly weren't as good as this team.
No, and back then, really, the only other challenger was Manchester United. It was pretty much a straight fight between those two for a decade, and United weren't great that season. I mean, what we forget about Arsenal's Invincibles team, I know that Adrian Durham, our esteemed TalkSport colleague, mentions it a lot. They drew 11 games that season. And now City have got 4 or 5 teams at the top end of the table. Maybe you can include United in that, maybe not. But certainly the rest of them who on their day can turn up and give Manchester City a run for their money. So, yeah, listen, they were never going to go the whole season unbeaten. I still think even though they're second in the table, they're in a very good position for the reasons that you've said in earlier podcasts that they've got, and you include now Chelsea, most of their more difficult away games out of the way. So the second half of the season looks relatively plain sailing.
They've played everybody away from home apart from Manchester United. Everyone. And they've done brilliantly in terms of the points all that they've picked up away from home. To only lose one game and only concede 2 goals is pretty, pretty impressive. There's no doubt in my mind they'll win the league, despite the fact that Liverpool are top. What I think it did do at the weekend was mean that there is a completely different view from everywhere about how the league could go. There's so many possibilities now. My opinion is that Manchester City will win it, but somebody else might have a different position now, and Liverpool have got encouragement.
I think they've done really well, Liverpool, just to stay on Manchester City's coattails. The irony about Saturday was Liverpool weren't brilliant, and Mohamed Salah played really well. A couple of the goals he took superbly, but the first goal, of course, would have been ruled out by VAR. Steve Cook, the Bournemouth defender, has had a day to forget. He actually apologised to his teammates afterwards, having scored an own goal, been at fault for at least 2 of the other 3. So Bournemouth weren't at the races. But listen, you can only beat the team in front of you, and Liverpool done that with aplomb.
Michelle, what I really want to know is what's happened with you and Neil Warnock this week, because when he was 70, you presented him with a wonderful cake on his birthday. And I don't know, was it your 35th or your 40th birthday this weekend? But did he get you a cake?
Considering by far I'm the youngest on this podcast, that's I'm the right side of 30. Thank you, Sam Matterface. It was Neil Warnock's 70th the week before last, and I can't even claim to have gone and bought him the birthday cake. I was on a late shift at Sky Sports News, and we had this grand plan to get him a lovely cake and card. So I sent my husband off to a late night supermarket to go and buy all these things, and he came up trumps.
Was it and, in the caterpillar?
Oh, no, no, this was a sausage dog. Because I said, look, he really likes his dog, so get him a dog cake. So he came up with this lovely upgrade from Colin the Caterpillar. And we had card, we had cake, we had balloons, banners. On Friday, and this wasn't his actual birthday, on Friday, I went to go and cover the Cardiff City Presser on my actual birthday. And
you're so good.
I arrived thinking maybe he gets me a cake here. Maybe somehow he knows. And he sat down and goes, don't let me talk for too long today. I've got somewhere to be. And he was probably the least chatty he's been all season, and off he disappeared. No cake for me.
Not gutted. Even a card. Not even a greeting of any kind.
No, and just a stale biscuit from the plate put out for the media. So great start to my birthday, but it's okay. I got over that quickly and went ahead and had some nice afternoon tea. But then on Saturday, just talking about cake and drink, I walked into the Birmingham City press room and was getting myself a rather large coffee, with it being the day after my birthday. And have you guys been in these press rooms where they have like the tables that fold down onto the seats? You sort of like move them back and forth.
Yeah.
Put everything down, put my coffee down. I had my new handbag there for my birthday, chatting away to a lot of the media guys that I know well, but not that well. Not well enough to make a fool out of myself in front of. Put the coffee down and it just went on the table. The table flopped over, coffee everywhere.
Over you?
On people's shoes, on my new handbag, on the carpet. And I'm like, oh, I don't actually know anyone in this media room that well. This is quite embarrassing. And the lady came over. She goes, oh, it's the boys in the week. They take all the screws out of the little tables in the hope that something like this happens. I said, well, I'm glad I've made their Monday when they come in. It's just some sort of practical joke. I know. So I was like,
because those tables,
well, they'll be happy.
For people who haven't used them, they're like old school tables or in like a lecture theatre where it's just like a single seat. And it has like a little tiny desk, which is enough room really to put a laptop on so you can tap away in a press conference or something like that.
I think
it folds
up
in the back so you can get in and out of it. So people like Crook, for example, can actually get out of the chair.
It's a tight squeeze for everyone. Don't be mean to Crook.
Absolutely,
so, there
Michelle,
we are.
Well said.
And do you know how important our notes are to us? Obviously, I have my pages of prep. Just absolutely, I'm not kidding, dripping in coffee. So I had to get rid of all my prep and put it in the bin.
I once did a commentary at Vicarage Road, the old Vicarage Road, in the stand that was eventually condemned. And I had a hot cup of coffee and I was doing a game between Watford and Portsmouth. And during the game, I spilt the coffee right into my lap, right on my crown jewels everywhere. Ooh. Boiling hot coffee in the middle of a commentary. And I just had to continue. I could do nothing about it. Could do nothing about it.
Little high-pitched voice for the rest of the commentary.
Oh, God, it was...
He's got that anyway.
Right, you are listening to the All Football Commentators of Geeks podcast. And remember, you can follow on Instagram or get in touch with us via Twitter. The handles are the same, @AFCGeeks. And send us your questions. We'll get to them when we can in the next episode.
Tweet the Geeks @AFCGeeks or get in touch on Instagram.
You are listening to All Football Commentators Are Geeks. Time now to introduce this week's special guest geek. And Michelle railroaded her Sky Sports colleague Kelly Cates into giving us chapter and verse on life as Kenny Dalglish's daughter and working with Gary Neville.
I'm in the Sky Canteen and with Kelly Cates, who has kindly given me some of your time before you go and present the debate tonight. Kelly, obviously you're across Sky everywhere, Premier League, the debate, you present on Five Live as well, you work for Premier League Productions, but let's go back to the start. What was your very first job in sports broadcasting and how did it come about?
It started here. It started at Sky Sports News. And when they decided to launch the channel in 1998, they realised that it was going to require a lot of people and probably more people that they could get who had the necessary experience. Mm. So they just employed a load of people who were fresh out of university and went, right, go and make telly. Wow. So we all sort of turned up and played at making television programmes, and it was we were really lucky because we got to do loads of hours of lives which you just wouldn't get the opportunity to do. It was just one of those moments where everybody just had this fantastic opportunity.
Thrown in the deep end, quite
completely. Yeah.
And I was on air a few months ago, it was the 20th anniversary of Sky Sports News, and you were there like on the first day
first
with
morning.
Short hair with
Jules.
Mike Wedderburn. Oh, was it
Mike Wedderburn? Yep, me and Mike Wedderburn.
And but Jules has been here since the start as well. Jules
yes,
as well,
yes, yeah.
He? And how long were you at Sky Sports News for?
It would be 9 years.
9 years, wow.
Yeah, 9 years it was, because I left... I left 2000, end of 2006, 2007. We went over to cover the World Cup in Germany. We were based in Berlin for a while. Dave Jones and I went out. And then came back from there and I thought, I need to go and do something different. So I left with nothing to go to.
No,
I just jumped. I just went, I need to go and do something different. And if I don't go now,
I'll never go.
Yeah, so.
And what did you find when you left?
Well, I went and I worked a little bit with ESPN and Satanta, mm-hmm. basically all the channels that either don't exist or exist in a very different form at the moment. So I did a little bit for them, did some pitch side reporting, did a little bit with did a show on Satanta Sports News, like an hour long interview type show. And yeah, I just, and then what else did I do? Then worked with Premier League Productions, as you know, which was sort of later on, but also at the same time I had my first daughter in 2008 as well, so I was working a bit less, and it suited me not to be working as much at that time. So yeah, it all just kind of slotted into place a bit.
I think that's an important thing to touch on for female listeners of the podcast, because you know there's probably loads of women that work in sport or want to work in football and think, oh, what happens if I go away and I want to have kids? Have you found it, obviously it's worked out well?
It didn't but I didn't plan it that way. But I couldn't have planned it better, really, in the way that it worked. But I think if you're freelance, that there is that fear that you're not going to get the work. But because I was working for two or three different companies, it meant that I could pick the one that suited me just to keep things ticking over. Because I felt it was important not to disappear completely. That would have,
you want to still have a hand in.
You want to still have a hand in. You want to still be doing something that keeps your brain moving. You want to still be across everything that's going on. But at the same time, I didn't want to be away, you know, 5 days a week and kind of missing out on loads of stuff. That wouldn't have suited me. And I know there's people who feel differently, and they'll go straight back in and happy to go, and you know, it's whatever suits you. But it wouldn't have fitted with me at the time. And I think it is, as much as, you know, there are two parents involved, I do think as a woman you take more of that on naturally, even though we shouldn't, and even though if we were talking to our friends we'd say no, obviously you share everything and it's not all on you, but there is a part of, or there certainly was a part of me that felt like it was, I wanted it to be my responsibility.
But you managed to get that balance, and then from that, at what point did you go and do the Football League highlights?
So that would be about 4 years ago. So I must have done them for two years, maybe, something like that. Did I just do a season? I maybe only did a season there. Then came to Sky to do the live EFL matches.
Was it that Sky saw you on that and thought, we'd like you back?
Not really. Well, because a lot of the people I worked with when I first started now are in a position to offer me work.
Which is
quite nice. But it was a little bit that, a little bit the stuff on the radio, and it was that they were looking for somebody.
Were you doing Five Live by that point?
Yeah. So they were looking for somebody to come in and host the EFL. And I think actually they were employing a few different people at the same time. So they weren't quite sure when I first started talking to them what I was going to be doing exactly. So we just had a cup of tea and a chat and sort of worked it out. And eventually that was what they came back with, was the EFL live matches, which was great fun. And then obviously as much as that's done in the studio, I like going to the live games. So I did the EFL Cup as well. So you go and you do the League Cup. It's brilliant. Get to go to the games and be on location, which you get a completely different feel for it, I think, from when you're sitting in the studio.
And when you're doing that, obviously that led to the Premier League now. And I mean, I think you're like me, like, because I love the Football League as much as I love the Premier League, but you're presenting these massive kickoffs to the Premier League now. So was that a natural progression?
Well, actually the way it came about was because Simon Thomas was doing that job, and we know the circumstances in which that came about, and it was temporary. And I was only ever filling in for Simon until he decided that he didn't want to come back. So that it was always his decision to make. It was always his job.
Absolutely.
And I was just kind of
keeping it
taking over. But then he decided that he didn't want to do that, so they just kept me on.
You obviously did a very good job.
No, well, they had someone there. It's better that than an empty seat.
But how has that been doing these massive Premier League games? I mean, if you could pick one out from the last sort of year or so, which one would you pick out?
Funnily enough, I've been thinking, because we've got another Christmas one coming up on the 21st. But the one we did last year was Arsenal-Liverpool, which was the really late equalisers. And that's great fun, because you're coming down from where we're watching the game and you're running through the stands, and Gary Neville and I are sort of running through trying to get down to the pitch to kind of do the post-match interview on the pitch. And we can hear that you lose all your communications, so you can't hear anything, you've got no idea what's happened. You get down and you're like, what have we missed? What's happening? So who are we talking to then? What's going to happen? So then, but when it's like that's when I love it, when it's all sort of slightly chaotic and and up in the air. So yeah, that one I remember.
I think what people don't realise about your job is that you don't have an alter cue. So you're stood pitch side, you know, with this, sometimes you have that little desk thing, Gary's next to you, but all you have is an iPad with a few notes on.
Yeah.
And people don't, you know, you're so good at it. It's a credit to you, I think.
Or in the studio we don't have alter cue either for the live games. But I think it works better because I think sometimes if there's an opener where you're out of vision, you'll probably have some notes on that and you'll have a bit of script to go over, just for timing reasons more than anything else. But if you're trying to link into a VT, or if you're trying to, ask a question off the back of something, you can't predict what it's going to be. So it's a waste of time to have autocue, because you can tie yourself in more knots trying to get to the point of the question or the whatever it is, the link that's in autocue. There's no point in having it because it changes all the time.
And whatever you want to talk about is reflected in the game or whatever the pundit's coming back to you with, isn't it?
Exactly. So you can't predict it. It's different in a news situation where you want to keep everything really tight and it's important that the words are used really concisely and really sparingly. You're trying to get certain points across. But in that situation, it just doesn't work to have it to keep.
There's not many people that work right at the top of TV and radio, but you do both, which is amazing. How do you find having that variety and working on Five Live for these big Champions League nights?
I absolutely love it. You know, I'm off to Anfield for the Napoli game on Tuesday to go and do that, and you know, I love it because you get to go, like you say, to the Champions League games, and I get to go to these big occasions. Also, I love radio as a medium. I just think it allows you and allows the guests to say so much more in a very different way. And if something goes off slightly on a tangent, you can pick up on it. It's not as rigid as television. But then I really like the discipline of trying to keep things really tight in a live game for television. So I love that I get to do both, because they're very different ways of hosting. So it's fun for me, and it's also helpful to me. It keeps me thinking, and it stops me from getting stale, and it makes me think about what I'm asking, why I'm asking it, what I want to get out of the guests, how tight and I want their answers to be, and you know, trying to keep it all together. I like being able to do both. Love being able to do both.
Now, I'm pretty sure that you've been in press conferences with your dad. Haven't
you? No, not press conferences.
Never the presses?
No.
Have you ever done an interview with him?
Yes, yeah. I have interviewed him.
I thought it was one of the two. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, I've done a couple of sit-down interviews with him over like 20 years. I've done
what was
about
that
two
like?
Not as weird as I thought it might be, because I think we did one when they redid Hampden and they reopened Hampden, and so we did one sort of like memories piece and something like that. And the other one was just a sort of long form, sat down for an hour and chatted to him. But the thing is, because in real life I don't talk to him really about that kind of thing. You know, because I don't talk to him about that kind of thing. It felt like work. So even though I knew him, and the thing is, I work with people I know quite often.
Friends.
So it's not So it's not that different. But it is nice to be able to talk to somebody where you know them, and where actually, if they're going off on a tangent or whatever, you can bring them back quite quickly, because you're like, yeah, no, that's not right. You don't need to worry about being too polite. you can just go straight in with it. But I thought it'd be strange, but actually it wasn't, because because of what we were talking about, it felt like work.
Yeah. And what was it like growing up in that household? Yeah, I'm sure many people would absolutely love to know.
And I haven't got a good answer, because that was normal
for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. So I had nothing to compare it to. So also, it wasn't as though Dad came home and was, you know, and brought work home particularly.
It was just your...
The game was around. Like, we watched the bit if there was football on, it would be on all the time, game was on, it would be. But I think that's the same in lots of houses. So it wasn't unusual in that sense. And when he came home, it wasn't like he talked about his job, if that makes sense. So football was around, but the actual particulars of his job he wouldn't come home and talk about. So he was Dad at home, and it wasn't strange, and it wasn't different. And like you said, there was nothing else to compare it to.
And did you always love football?
Yeah, that was I used to go when mum and dad first moved down. So the other question that you normally get when people do things like this, do you remember your first game? No, because when mum and dad moved down from Glasgow to Liverpool, I was 2 and my brother was a baby, and mum didn't know anybody, didn't have babysitters, didn't have everything, so didn't have anything like that. So she'd just take us to the game. So I went from being a toddler. I think he had a few years. Around about a 7, 8, 9 maybe, where I decided I didn't like it and I didn't want to go anymore. But that was just me being difficult, I think, rather than then. And then I said, "Oh well, I'll come to the first game of the season." And then, after that, I was like, "Yeah, I think I will come back again."
And what do your parents think about how you've done with your career off your own back?
Yeah, it's funny. They My mum always says, "Oh, I just turn in to see what you're wearing, and then I turn off again." So I don't really listen.
Such a
I don't really
thing
listen.
To
yeah.
say.
I don't really listen to what you're saying. I just want to see if it.
See if you look nice.
Yeah. And if you've been out the night before, I want to see if you like how tired you look. And then dad will ring up and he'll be like, "Are you doing that? What are you doing on Tuesday? What are you doing on Thursday? Or whatever." Anyway, because I was just thinking about such a thing. And if he gets a bee in his bonnet about something, he'll phone up and say, "Are you going to be doing that?" And I'm like, "Well, probably
really?
Not by the time. Probably not by the time Thursday comes up." Yeah, but I mean, but it just because someone knows football doesn't mean they necessarily know television, radio. It's a different thing. Why did such and such said this? What do you think they meant? And I'm like, I don't know. And I've finished. I'm going home.
I don't care. Dad,
what
I'm
do you? Think
yeah.
they meant this, because that's really what you phoned to say, isn't it? You don't really care what I think. You won't phone to tell me what you think.
Absolutely. And when you got married, you changed your name?
Yes. Yeah.
Did you... What? Can I just ask, what was your thinking behind that?
We wanted to have children, and yeah. I wanted to have the same name as them. That was
that's
it.
Simple.
It was that. That was why. And I spoke to a friend of mine who changed her name at... Well, she kept her maiden name on air and changed it on passports and things like that, so that she would have the same name as her husband and their family.
That's what I've done, yeah.
And she said it was a nightmare, things like booking travel
it
for work.
It is an absolute
yeah.
nightmare.
She said, "But anybody books yeah. a flight," she said, "anything you need your passport or ID for." She said, "You have to have
this."
Yeah, that's what she said. So I just thought, do you know what? I'm just going to do it.
I wish someone had told me that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just thought, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do it.
Wise decision. Yeah. But do you find people sometimes don't make that link now?
Yeah, increasingly. So, or people know and then have forgotten. I think because it's not there and in their face all the time, because obviously it's an unusual name.
Yeah, very much so.
That it's recognisable if you know football. And so it's... But because that's out of the equation, people, they might know and not remember, or they might never have known,
yeah.
or it might, especially with things like with doing the Premier League productions, with the stuff that goes out abroad, people wouldn't even think to make the
make the
connection.
Do you like that?
I mean, I don't hate it the other way either.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't hate that people make the link. I don't hate it when that happens. You know, I think there was probably a time when I did feel as though I wanted to kind of to stand on my own 2 feet and to be a sort of person who's separate from that. But then, not now. I think I feel now I'm really proud of what he's done. I don't, you know, it's not
also
like,
in your own right as well. You're a fantastic broadcaster.
But not even about that. It's not even about where I am. It's about the fact that but it is part of my life. You know,
yeah.
and he is my dad. So
proud
why on earth would I pretend that that wasn't the case?
Yeah.
So I don't hate it. I did for a while find it quite strange that it was the first thing that everybody
did. People always
about.
Say to you, you know, "Are you his daughter or whatever?"
Yeah, well, yes, I get that sometimes, but mostly now to be honest now, mostly when it's people I work with who know them, they go, "Hi," and to be honest, they're as likely to say, "How's your mum and dad?" as they are to say, "How's your dad?" Because if they know them, so it's not really, it's more social than it is work.
And what do you think sort of the next few years has in store for you?
I don't
it's
know.
A hard
I've
question,
been busy, and that's
you're
the thing
so busy.
As well.
I mean, look, you're doing Five Live, you're doing Sky, you're doing Premier League productions.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, how do you ever have a life?
No, it's not too bad. It's not too bad. I've got it down to about 4 or 5 days a week. It looks more than it is. but yeah, it's not too bad. I kind of it works out quite well. And actually, where things are at the moment, I feel quite settled. So I'm not really looking to make any big changes, and I don't have any grand plans to do anything. I like what I do at the moment, so I'm just giving myself time to just sit still and be a bit steady at the moment.
Absolutely right. You're fantastic. We're so pleased to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Thank you for coming.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Welcome back to All Football Commentators Are Geeks. Now, for all the brilliant football we witnessed at the weekend, sadly, we also saw some very disturbing scenes as Raheem Sterling was the subject of vile abuse during Manchester City's 2-0 defeat at Chelsea. It follows the equally unpalatable episode where a banana was hurled at Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang during last weekend's North London derby. Joining us now is the former Fulham and West Ham star Leroy Rossignol. Leroy, thanks, first of all, for sparing us your time. You make of events at Stamford Bridge on Saturday?
Well, I was watching the game live, and I was watching a friend of mine, Don Hutchinson, and Don was just, his eyes almost popped out of his head. He was so animated, and I wasn't surprised at all. And we had a little discussion about it, and I said, that happens all the time, Don. It's just that the cameras have caught it, and it was right in your face. And we had a discussion about it, and I was telling them about, you know, but what did you think about the reaction of the people around him? I said, that said a lot more. Obviously, we need to deal with the abuser, which we'll come to, I suppose, at some point. But the people around him, it's mostly something that they're used to because they weren't fazed by it at all. I'm sure there's some people who don't like it at all, but they don't feel that they're empowered enough to challenge it in the right way. And that's not challenging it directly, but having a way of dealing with it in terms of reporting it anonymously to the authorities. And that's what came out of it for me. But people have been asking me today, you're not the first people who have been on to me, they've been asking me, what's the next step? And I've been saying for the last 10 years, we need to make the next step. It's not fining the club £20,000 and then getting on with your lives. It's not just rapping someone on the knuckles and say, OK, just carry on. It's rapping someone on the knuckles with the correct punishment, and it's followed up by education, because there needs to be an element of redemption here as well for the person who's done it. Is he racist or is he just ignorant? We need to find that out, and we need to get to that point. Why is he doing that? Why does he feel it's all right? Why is it condoned where he lives to use that sort of to behave like that and use that sort of language? There's so many things that we need to do and we haven't done for a very long time. But because it's happening in the Premier League, it's happened, you know, to an Arsenal player, it's happened to a Man City player, it's on the front page of the newspapers, and maybe that's a good thing.
I think you believe, because of the way that the campaigns have gone, the Kick It Out campaign's done some fantastic work over the last 20 years, because we work in commentary boxes and in press rooms and we go to football matches and we mix with people who do not hold those bigoted views, we don't hear as much of this, and sometimes you can be maybe naive in thinking that it's been eradicated from football in this country, but it really hasn't. And if you go, I went to an FA Cup semi-final about 8 years ago, and it was vile. It was vile. And a friend of mine said to me, you know, I just can't sit here anymore. I just can't sit. And he left. He left the game. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, if you go outside some of the metropolitan areas of this country, you will find, if you travel around this country, and some people, you know, I grew up in inner city London, so it's a bit different, and there's been a lot of multiculturalism where I've grown up over the course of my life. But in other parts of the country, it isn't like that, and people have got very strange, very backdated, outdated views. And that's still prevalent. There needs to be a lot of education in schools, with kids, with parents, with older people.
Yeah, absolutely. But then you're talking about the last two incidents, Alex, were in London. One was at Chelsea and one was at the Emirates. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, a multicultural society, the multicultural crowds. At Chelsea, a black player just scored at the other end for his team, or was about to score, and they still felt it was all right. So there's a little bit more to it than that, because there are people, what it is, it's not that people have those views, is they have no views. They have no way of asking the right questions to the right people. And we have to ask difficult questions of people to get the difficult answers. I just turn my attention to the media. We are all part of a media. And the language used in the media sometimes, it's not good enough. It isn't good enough. You know, and Raheem is right, and it's been happening for a very long time. I'll give an example. John Barnes, when he played well for England, he was the England player. When he didn't play well, he was the Jamaican-born player. when there's an incident regarding a Muslim, that person is firstly described as a Muslim. You don't see other people described as the Christian. There's all these things in the media which kind of subliminally affect people in a negative way. And that has got to change. And so, you know, there's so many things that we need to tackle. But firstly, we need to look at ourselves and say, are we doing our bit? Are we doing our bit to make sure that our society is absolutely right? And now people say, oh, you know, when you use the wrong language, it's just PC. That's just, why would you not be PC if you don't want to upset someone's feelings? You use the correct words. And I give them an example. My children are what people call mixed race. I refuse my children to be called mixed race because that infers that one of the parents is an alien. Why would I do that?
But the interesting thing about that, Leroy, is that I've spent a lot of my working life with Stan Collymore, and he became very, very vocal about the fact that he wasn't allowed to call himself mixed race anymore, and that he felt as if he was being pressurised into calling himself mixed heritage.
Well, that's fine.
But so is it personal? Is it a personal choice?
It's a personal choice, but when I'm teaching children about how many races they are, and they're putting their hands up saying there's 10, and I have to remind them that there's only one, that's the starting point, isn't it? So it's quite simple. Yeah. Well, how many races are there? There's only one, so how many people race? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And we listen to politicians talking about different races all the time. There aren't any different races. They're just people with maybe different colour scheme and different nationalities and different cultures. And this language infers awful things. It infers differences between people, which people take in different ways. And we need to sort that sort of thing out. And so everybody needs to take responsibility from top to bottom.
I was going to ask you, Leroy, about... I was going to ask you, Leroy, about Raheem's tweet, really accusing some sections of the media of almost treating him differently to they would a white player of his stature, but you've really touched on that already. What about clubs themselves? Because I remember reporting on the racism row involving Jay Rodriguez and Gitan Bong last season, and the fallout from it when Bong was actually abused in a game at Turf Moor, because, of course, Rodriguez is a former Burnley player and a bit of a darling up there. And I went to the Burnley press office for a statement, and what they issued, to me, was very wishy-washy. They almost refused to condemn their own supporters for what was clearly racist abuse in the fallout of this incident. Can clubs do more? Can clubs be stronger?
Look, firstly, the way these incidents are handled, and I go back to the John Terry incident, but I'll just talk about that one. The first thing they do is they accuse someone of being racist. Well, if you accuse anybody of being racist, it's going to get their back up. And they're going to get on the defensive. They need to be investigated properly. And then these players have got a great opportunity to come together to one, to say, you know what, if I did say that, I was wrong and I apologise. I didn't realise what it meant. And the other one to say, you know what, I'll accept your apology. Because most players are like that, by the way. But what they do, they get lawyers involved. They get all these people who have no idea about how to deal with these things with a positive outcome, not only for their players, but for the people they represent, their football clubs and their local communities. And they come to head on, just trying to, you know, you have people say, oh, that player, he's not racist. I think Jose Mourinho said John Terry's not racist at the time. Yeah, well, how would Jose Mourinho know whether he was racist or not? He's not going to go and tell anybody, is he? It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. The Suarez incident, absolutely ridiculous. Kenny Dalglish sends his players out with T-shirts. He doesn't know. It's ridiculous. These things need to be handled more sensitively from both sides. So the one who's abused comes out feeling, you know what, I didn't know that's the effect I had on those people. So I don't think John Terry is a racist, by the way. And I don't think Luis Suarez is a racist. I think what they did was something that they've done many times and never been hauled up on it. Because I know that John Terry gets on with many, many people, as does Luis Suarez. And it could have been an unbelievable outcome. Imagine John Terry and Luis Suarez at the end of it saying, sat with a person who was the abuse, and them saying, you know what, we didn't represent ourselves very well, but we're going to do something about it, we're going to educate ourselves. But it never comes out like that. So these people who want to protect the players' reputations are not protecting their players' reputations, they're doing the reputation of the game no good whatsoever.
I think it's fascinating to hear you talk about the way people want recrimination. And I wonder whether or not that is fueled by social media in a way. it seems as if as soon as there's an incident, there needs to be blame. There needs to be apportioned blame and punishment and whatever, when actually probably what you're saying, and I don't want to put words in your mouth here, is instead of that, maybe the better way of dealing with it is by educating people just to behave better towards one another.
Exactly. Look, there's a list, there's a way, there's a priority thing. First, you condemn it, so you send out the right message to everybody that this is not acceptable. Secondly, you educate. And then thirdly, the person who's educated, hopefully they're remorseful and there's redemption. They come out and say, do you know what? That is the best thing that's ever happened to me. I'll never do it again. That's how you deal with it. That's how you change people's perception, you know? And then that person who's done it, we've seen it before. How many people are counsellors who've been, I don't know, alcoholics? Do you know what I mean? How many people are counsellors who've been abused? Because they know what they understand it, and they pass it on to their children. That's the way to deal with these things, in a positive way, with a positive outcome. Not a £20,000 fine, and let's get on it, onto it again, and it'll happen again. You know, that's what just frustrates the hell out of me. But I'm hoping this is the last time that these people will react like that, and they will try and deal with it in a positive way. And it's not, you know, these aren't just my ideas. These are ideas from people from Ticket Out, people from Show Racing, the Red Card. We want positive outcomes. We don't want people going away thinking, oh, you know what, I've been banned from the ground. I'll have to go down the pub and do the same there. That's the worst thing that can happen.
What did you think, Leroy, of the way Raheem Sterling dealt with the situation in that moment? It must be incredibly difficult to have that literally in your face while you're trying to play football.
Yeah, it is, but it's obviously something he's had before, because he just laughed it off and he got on with playing the game. But you know what I was really impressed with, Michelle, was that afterwards he came out, and as a 23-year-old black footballer, to come out and say that, you know, that the media are fueling racism, and to back it up, by the way, in some way, I thought that was really mature. All overnight, he's become a role model, because there's not... I didn't open my mouth until I'd finished playing, because I didn't think I had the platform to do it. And there's so many players who don't open their mouths. And now that you can imagine what it means to a lot of people who are at grassroots level are getting the same sort of treatment. They will now, when it happens to them, they will go and report it in the right way. He didn't react at the time. He didn't get angry, which a lot of players do. And by the way, I can understand that. He went away, thought about it, and thought, how can I... And he's been mostly sitting on this for many, many months. And he's reacted in a really positive way. And he's got everybody thinking. And that, and no matter what you say about Raheem Sterling, I was listening to a show yesterday. I had people talking about, maybe he brings it on himself because of his social media. You know, maybe why does he wear that tattoo? Well, it's got nothing to do with it. He can do what he wants, whether you agree with it or not, whether you like it or not. That's got absolutely nothing to do with it. It's got nothing to do with it that he's a multi-millionaire and he's got a big house. Nothing to do with it. This affects everybody every day. And that's the point I'm trying to make. And him, yesterday, I thought it was magnificent. He's come away from a game that they've lost, and he's tweeted something that has got everybody talking, everybody thinking, what can we do more to make sure that this doesn't happen again? And by the way, it will happen to him again at some point, because you know that. But the effect it will have on grassroots football and young black players and people who watch young black players is immeasurable. And so he deserves a hell of a lot of credit.
Yes, he does. And I wonder whether or not you think that the idea of abuse around football has become almost uncontrollable. Because there was some suggestion that it wasn't a racist term. Someone said mank. Even if that was the case, and I don't think from what we've seen subsequently that we believe that is the case, that wouldn't be okay either, would it? There's nothing really attractive about someone standing 5 yards from another human being and shouting, spitting bile at someone. Has football got a problem with that?
Look, it has got a problem with that, because we, as you said, it's become a totally accepted part of the game that you abuse your opponents, the abuse the other fans. And you know what? I'm all for a laugh and people having a little go at me. Somebody says, oh, Jose, you're rubbish. As people did a lot, by the way, when I played. You know, that wasn't a problem. And you know what? I wouldn't even bother me if they had a little swear word in there as well, because that's the nature of the game. It's a working class game. But when people start tagging on, you know, you're big, you're this, you're that, your colour, your skin colour, that's when it becomes unacceptable. And that's when we have to deal with those things head on. And this was one of those things. I was talking to someone earlier this morning about the difference between. They said, what about if someone calls someone fat? What if they call someone skinny? What if somebody calls, you know, you four eyes because you're wearing glasses? And I was saying about the difference between discrimination and racism. And that, you know, discrimination, when it happens to you, is horrible. And by the way, you feel exactly the same as when someone's been racist. But it only affects you. It's directed right at you. It doesn't make it right, but it's directed at you. When somebody's racist to you and calls you a blackness or has a go at your religion, it affects everything that you stand for, you, your family. And that's why people get so upset. And that's why these things lead on to more serious things. And they thought, well, I didn't really, I thought discrimination and racism were the same. Well, they're not, they're different. And not that, but when you feel it, it's exactly the same feeling. So when a white person says to me, you know what, I've never had any racism, so I don't know what it's like. Well, you have. You can get an idea of it because someone has called you a name at school where it's made you feel horrible. We've all had it. And that's how a person like me feels all the time. But when it relates to your family, it is 100% worse. And so that's the way I try and explain what racism is and what it does to society. It tears people apart. It creates wars. It has done in history. And it will continue to do so. And that's why we have to make sure that in a modern society, we need to erase it as much as possible.
Just finally, Leroy, I don't want to get too political here, but is this just a football problem or is it a problem with society in general that's got worse because of what's going on in Westminster at the moment and the fact that, on the face of it, the country is as divided as ever because of Brexit and because of other decisions that have been made from our political parties.
What I would say is that if you look at history, these things kind of lie dormant, you know, and they're under the surface. And then you have a happening of some type, like Brexit, like Donald Trump, where people think, OK, now you know, it's OK for me to spout this sort of stuff because I do actually believe it. And they'll use something like, as an excuse, I don't know, the immigration issue, where people who are obviously concerned about immigration and the way that it affects their communities talk about it. But there are other people who use it as a way of spouting racist nonsense. And so these things come in cycles. And it is linked to society. But football has a responsibility because football now has such an impact on our lives on a daily basis. You can't get away from it and you can't separate the two. And so when people leave a football ground and ask for a football match, football has a responsibility. You can't wash your hands of it. We have to educate. We have to use all that wealth and all that opportunity when you get 60,000 people in one place. What an opportunity that is on a regular basis to educate on a regular basis. And that's what football needs to do. It needs to take responsibility. It has done to a certain extent within the game. You know, it's a criminal offence to abuse someone in a football ground. Now, that is law. But when people leave a football ground, football has a responsibility to those people as well that they have a safe and happy journey home and they live a safe and happy home in that community that football club represents. And that's what I want to see from now on.
Leroy, thank you very much for coming on the programme. It was a brilliant interview. It was fantastic. And I hope that people listen to that and react to it, take it on board. And I hope that everything that you've suggested is a pathway for the future. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Right, I'm afraid we are out of time for another week. Thanks to our superb guests this week, Kelly Cates and Leroy Rosenia, for joining us. Sam, Alex and myself will be back next week with Arsenal legend Lee Dixon.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.